Hey Nexus friends, when Brad asked me a couple of months ago whether I would be interested in reading Willie Jennings' commentary on Acts and participating in a group discussion, I thought to myself, yeah, sure. Kids are back in school, finally getting some of my working hours back. This could be a great opportunity. Of course, that was in November, and it didn't exactly work out the way I hoped. But over the holidays and in pockets of quiet in the house during lockdown, I managed to find some time to explore the Book of Acts and also Jennings' work. And I'm excited to share some of the highlights I found in both the commentary and in discussions with a few other Nexus folk who are reading along too. So it's interesting, in our group discussions, we all had different experiences with the Book of Acts. Some more familiar, others reading it for the first time. And I would imagine that might be true for those of you listening as well over the past couple of weeks. For me, the Book of Acts has been familiar for some time. I guess I've always kind of found it fascinating. And maybe that sounds a bit rich, but let me put it in context for you. You see, growing up, my family attended the Christian Reformed Church. It's a rather traditional, conservative Protestant denomination, attended by mostly the descendants of Dutch immigrant farmers who left Holland following World War II. Now, my experience was that when you transplant a culture and a community, it produces a very closely knit group of people, and almost like a family of sorts. In fact, many people were distantly related. It didn't take long to find common acquaintances when visiting other Christian Reform communities, which are scattered around southern Ontario. As a family, we went to church twice every Sunday, once in the morning, once in the evening. We had Sunday school in the morning ahead of our sometimes two-hour services. We went to Christian school, where all the kids who went to the church were also in that school. We also did Christian studies with our version of Boy Scouts, which we called cadets, and that was every Thursday night. And needless to say, by the time I was, you know, maybe 10, I had read through the Book of Acts many times already by virtue of hearing countless sermons and lessons. But I always liked Acts. As a kid, especially, there are some wild stories that kind of captured my fascination. Shipwrecks and snake bites, speaking in tongues, miraculous healings. I often got so bored in church, but I was allowed to read the Bible instead of listening to the sermons. So naturally, I chose the juicy stories. I generally preferred Old Testament blood and gore, but sometimes I found myself in the Book of Acts, you know, for a little bit of New Testament displays of Holy Spirit, shock and awe. One such story that you'll find in the Book of Acts is that of Ananias and Sapphira. It's found in the fifth chapter, and I'm going to read it for you now. Now a man named Ananias, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property. With his wife's full knowledge, he kept back part of the money for himself. But he brought the rest and put it at the apostles' feet. Then Peter said, "Ananias, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept for yourself some of the money you received for the land? Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? Wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You've not lied just to human beings, but to God." When Ananias heard this, he fell down and died. And great fear seized all who heard what had happened. Then some young men came forward, wrapped up his body, and carried him out and buried him. About 3 hours later, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. Peter asked her, "Tell me, is this the price you and Ananias got for the land?" "Yes," she said, "that is the price." Peter said to her, "How could you conspire to test the Spirit of the Lord? Listen, the feet of the men who buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out also." At that moment, she fell down at his feet and died. Then the young men came in, and finding her dead, carried her out and buried her beside her husband. Great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events. as a child, reading this passage, it would always kind of just make my stomach drop. Wow, I'd think, you don't want to play around with the Holy Spirit. All Ananias and Sapphira did was tell what seemed to be a little white lie about how much money they were giving away. And it's a death sentence? To be honest, even now that I've come to look at the Bible as having layers of meaning rather than just reading it literally, it's passages like these that kind of make me question the arbitrary nature of God. I mean, what's going on here? I was very curious what Jennings would have to say about it in the commentary we were reading. I think he acknowledges the gravity of the situation when he says, "The demise of Ananias and Sapphira, husband and wife, is not glorious. Their deaths should never be celebrated or treated flippantly as some morality test case against lying to God." Luke has entered the frightening space where the name of God is mentioned in relation to violence and death. For Jennings, the death of Ananias and Sapphira is singularly important. He points out that it is in fact the Holy Spirit that carries out the violence. "The Spirit is moving," says Jennings. At this point, I'm still confused. I think, okay, the death of Ananias and Sapphira isn't a morality test, and the Holy Spirit is speaking directly through their deaths. How are you going to explain this, Willie Jennings? I mean, he's right about one thing. It's a little frightening. And I have to tell you, his take was certainly a departure from the traditional Christian Reform lessons I had received on Acts growing up, which was essentially, if you lie to God, you're going to pay big time. So listen to how Jennings frames the death of Ananias and Sapphira. He says, "There is an object of worship lurking inside even the would-be followers of Jesus. It is precisely as a couple that they plan their deception. It was precisely as a couple that they engaged in their economic calculations. And it was as a couple that Satan filled their hearts and they lied to the Holy Spirit." That's verse 3. "The couple agreed together to put the Spirit of the Lord to the test," verse 9. "And this is not the first couple to test God. Indeed, from the first couple made one flesh by God, God has had to contend against its plans that would resist the divine will." He says, here is the energy that drives the most powerful forms of cultural, social, or economic boundaries. Here is the fortress that resists the new order most consistently. Here is where the worship of possessions and money come fully to life. And the two made one flesh. So it does seem like maybe Jennings is referencing something a little bigger here than a little white lie or a morality test. The death of Ananias and Sapphira is actually what Jennings calls the death of the couple. The power of the couple, of two made one flesh, is really very striking if you stop and reflect on it. These are the deepest of bonds, and Jennings references this power as being part of Adam and Eve's original sin. "Together, they imagine they can do anything," he says. This kind of blew up Ananias and Sapphira for me. I think now we're starting to get to the heart of something that I can sink my teeth into. Here is a deeper issue of some consequence. This is a direct confrontation, a battle for power. It's happened before. And it appears the Holy Spirit is being unequivocal. The community of Jesus confronts the couple with a new truth. You belong to us. We do not belong to you. Jesus, in an utter act of terrorism, tore open ancient kinship networks. And now the Spirit will complete that work by forming the new family. So perhaps the indictment of Ananias and Sapphira is less trivial than it at first appears. According to Jennings, the Holy Spirit is directly attacking the original human power structure, the family. The term Jennings uses for family here immediately caught my interest. Ancient kinship networks. See, I've always had a deep curiosity surrounding ancient man, our early ancestors in prehistory or pre-writing. And my understanding is that ancient kinship networks are at the very core of how we as humans first began organizing ourselves. Francis Fukuyama is a fairly well-known political philosopher who wrote a book called The Origins of the Political Order. In this book, he starts from prehistory and attempts to trace through how humans have organized themselves politically. According to Fukuyama, our earliest ancestors lived in basic band-like societies comprised of roughly a few families. Your social world was limited to the circle of relatives surrounding you, who determined what you did, who you married, how you worshipped, and just about everything else in life. To be honest, it doesn't sound that far off what it was like growing up in the Dutch Christian Reformed community of my childhood. Anthropologist Ernest Gellner calls this the tyranny of the cousins. And according to Fukuyama, eventually humans discovered agriculture, and this allowed us to produce enough food that we could store excess through the lean months, enabling cities and civilizations to form. From here, these ancient kinship networks began to assert themselves more aggressively. Power becomes more centralized, and those who rose to the top always sought to pass that power on to their children. In fact, later in the book, Fukuyama explores more complex forms of central governance in the ancient world, and it becomes a repeating offense. Great kingdoms rise up only to be dragged down by nepotism and the powerful trying to preserve their wealth for their lineage. You see, I bet if we stopped and were to think about it, each one of us would be able to quickly come up with an example in their own life of how this power, this bond, this coupling of two made one flesh has consistently caused harm in the world simply by prioritizing the well-being of the couple, or by extension, the biological family, on the backs or at the cost of others. You can find examples of this in church, in politics, or even your community kids' hockey or baseball team. In fact, the scourge of nepotism is a plague on children's sports. Let me explain. From the age of about 8 to 12, my brother Jake and I were deeply in love with the game of baseball. We spent almost all of our summer organizing our vast collection of cards, playing catch, or the two-man version of the baseball game that we kind of invented together in our parents' diamond-shaped backyard. We took it very seriously. The competition was fierce. My brother's actually a pretty decent athlete. He ended up making some traveling teams. We were only 2 years apart, so it made for a mostly even matchup. And our whole identity was wrapped up in this. And I boldly proclaimed to anyone who was willing to listen that I, John Benjamins, would be a Major League Baseball pitcher. And we put the work in. And for what it was, you know, I could hold my own on the ball field. But I quickly found out that on almost every team, the coach's son would invariably be playing as well. And no matter how good they were, whether a decent player or absolutely terrible, they would end up batting leadoff and playing shortstop. And it would drive me nuts. I mean, come on, I thought. Isn't sports a meritocracy? It seems trivial, but when you think your entire world is wrapped up in baseball, it's very unjust. Another quick example, I think, is very easy to point towards the bitter political position that just played out in the States. No matter what you think of Donald Trump, and I think he's a bit of an idiot, it's hard to argue that the children had any qualifications for their plum post. Perhaps we can say there was no harm done. Ivanka had just as much right to her position as any. But Ananias and Sapphira remind me that the urge to consolidate power is dangerous. And much like their story and the 45th presidents, the end result is often violence. There are endless examples to choose from, really. But I think the story also calls for reflection closer to home. What of the church? Jennings asks us some key questions here, too. Christians often turn marriage from an act of worship into an object of worship, and turn the couple from a shared journey of disciples into the end goal of discipleship. The problem we face is not the couple, but its claimed sovereignty over intimacy and life together. And I would go even one step further from Jennings and say, in the church as well. How much wasted time has been spent agonizing over the Christian definition of couple, when it ought not really to be our primary concern from the get-go? The coming of Jesus states clearly there's a greater form of love. There's a new family. And that's our calling. I think we could go much further than this even. I would point to the modern church's attempt to claim heterosexual coupling and the traditional definition of marriage as the only bastion of God's love. I would say that has been deeply harmful and cancerous even. I remember when my aunt finally had the courage to tell our deeply conservative Dutch family that she was not heterosexual and that furthermore she'd found her life's partner and was planning to marry her. The family, excluding my father, thank goodness, condemned her for wickedness and early on refused to even eat a meal with my aunt. They forbade her wife, Deb, from attending family events. How quickly our desire to preserve the status quo, the power base, causes us to stray from the love that Jesus called for. You know, even if my family believed my aunt's lifestyle was sinful, surely they could have shown her the same grace as Jesus showed Zacchaeus, the tax collector, and sat down to a simple meal. Never mind that my Aunt Grace's marriage has been life-giving, and she's attributed her wife Deb's spiritual devotion in helping her to re-embrace much of her Christian heritage again. You know, finally, I ask you to think about your own family. I think the story of Ananias and Sapphira leaves us with a simple question. What are some of the hidden ways we might use family to establish division and social hierarchy? It doesn't have to be as egregious as some of the examples used this morning. I know that baseball coach example is really egregious, but stepping aside from that, I'd recommend checking out a documentary on Netflix called Capital in the 21st Century. It talks about basic economic principle in capitalist economies that shows the growth of wealth in the land-owning or asset-owning class has always outstripped the GDP or gross domestic product, which basically means, and forgive my rudimentary economics here, that the rich keep on getting richer and they are able to successively pass that wealth onto each generation of their family as long as they're somewhat reasonable with that wealth. And it'll only continue to get bigger. What will we do with our wealth living here in Canada? Of course, it's important to invest in our children. I recognize that. Don't get me wrong. I'll be putting money away for Abby and Jesse's education. Maybe help them get a start. But at the very least, I hope to instill in them the importance that love extends beyond taking care of those we share a genetic link with, and that the hoarding of power and wealth is not sanctioned just because we're a family. I do think this is a basic human impulse, though. Ancient kinship networks have been with us since the dawn of time. It's hard for me not to place my family at the apex of what is most important. And I suppose that's why there's value in community, in being reminded of one another's existence. And though I might find some of the Bible arbitrary at times, I can clearly see the benefits of broadening our love beyond the walls of family and the tyranny of cousins to include our neighbors as well. So it is my hope that Nexus will continue to be that community for all of us, that even though there's a pandemic, being cognizant of one another in whatever way possible remains as important as ever. Thanks so much. God bless everybody.